The alt-right movement has recruited, indoctrinated, and built networks of power in politics by surrounding itself with misinformation, disinformation, and outright crazy. Now, in doing so, some associated with the community have come to realize that their values don't necessarily align with this movement. So my guest today is Tina Nguyen, national correspondent for PUC, covering Donald Trump and the right. Previously, Tina was a White House correspondent and reporter for Politico, a staff reporter for Vanity Fair Hive, and an editor at Mediate. Her new book, which is what we're going to get into, The MAGA Diaries, My Surreal Adventures Inside the Right Wing and How I Got Out, covers her own journey, her background, her story into this world, in which she talks about and details the history of the alt-right, exposing how the movement recruits, trains, and indoctrinates. Her very first job was working for a little-known journalist at the time named Tucker Carlson. Yeah, that Tucker. Tuckums. We're going to get into all of that with Tina Nguyen here on the Michael Steele Podcast, coming up right after this. Hey, folks, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Yes, it is a new year, and guess what? It's snowing. It's snowing. Oh, I'm a sucker for snow. What can I say? It's a beautiful thing, and I'm enjoying it, so it just makes me feel really good. And I feel even better today because I've got Tina Nguyen on the podcast to talk about her latest book, which is The MAGA Diaries, My Surreal Adventures Inside the Right Wing and How I Got Out. Tina, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and happy new year and happy snow day, really.
Yes, yes. It's a beautiful thing. This is how, you know, you begin the new year with snow. It works for me. So, I had to do a slapdash read for the book because I got some clips from it, and then I had to go and scrounge a copy and start doing my, you know, speed read because I knew we were going to have a conversation. Then I ran into you in the studios of MSNBC, and you were just so delightful, and I'm so looking forward to this conversation with you because. In your writing of the MAGA Diaries, there was so much of myself that I saw when I was your age.
Oh my God, really?
And coming into the Republican Party. And it was, and I saw it this way. It's like, I came in under the mantle of Ronald Reagan. You come in under the mantle of MAGA, and it's this real interesting dynamics. Now, at one level, yes, it's, you know, there's a big difference between the two. But then, you know, the aspirational parts of the things that drew you in, your discovery of your own conservative roots, all of that was part of the same journey that I took as a young man. Before we get into the meat of the MAGA Diaries, give us a little bit of the sense of your journey in discovering, oh my God, I think I'm a conservative. Oh my God, I think I'm a Republican.
I mean,
particularly
I don't know
as
a
woman of color, particularly
it's
as
a weird place for it's a weird place of a woman of color to be. Here's the weird thing. I think I came into conservatism as a world, but I don't know whether I would have classified myself as a conservative.
See, that was me.
Yeah, exactly. Like, conservative was like those people who are in ties and boring and they're like balancing copies of Milton Friedman on their head so they could stand up properly or something.
Right.
But like, no, I was cool. I was someone who was hip and into free market economics and limited government. And I wasn't like those old guys. But I think what it was for me that kind of drew me to the world of conservatism in the first place. And I want to be like pretty distinct here. There is like conserve, like being a conservative, which is like adhering to those values. And then there is the world of conservatism, which I think is its own professional, cultural, like community network, really. And what drew me to that in the first place, because I had this pretty like 19-year-old person's view of how politics should work. And in that specific moment, the libertarian moment, I was so into the idea of rational self-interest, and that if everyone just kind of stepped back and acted in said rational self-interest, society would be a really good place. But they just were not taught to think in their rational self-interest. And here were a whole bunch of like-minded people who were trying to take that idea and translate it into reality. And also, I was a really big geek about the founding fathers. So when I went to Claremont McKenna, one of the things that drew me in was the fact that there was this research institute there literally called the Salvatore Center for the Study of Individual Freedom in the Modern World. And I'm just like, oh, yes, please.
More of that.
I want to be John Adams.
Yeah. Yes, with the hat and everything. It is so funny because that sense of that young perspective on an old established institution is actually fairly alluring, because you do have this sense of, I want to make change. This institution needs to change. I can do that change here. And that's been something that animated a lot of my thinking at the time. And I remember, having a conversation with my mom. Now, I am way older than you are. My first election was 1976. And I remember, looking at Gerald Ford, who'd just gone through hell with Watergate and suddenly becoming president of the United States upon Nixon's resignation, and the Vietnam War, the sexual revolution, still a lot of the cultural tensions around race, still living in a city that was coming out of its own form of segregation in Washington, D.C. So you have all these cultural things going on, all these political, economic, international things going on. And I remember asking my mom, okay, so, how should I do this? And she said, well, look, don't be a Democrat because I'm a Democrat. Don't be anything someone else is. Be yourself. Go discover who you are. And I said, okay. So I went off, like you, in search of John Adams, in search of, the founding fathers, reading the Federalist Papers and reading, histories of the parties. And what kind of locked it in for me, Tina, was the Republican Party was the home of Black people. This is where we began politically. The party was formed for our freedom. So it was this, and Abraham Lincoln was this towering figure. As a kid, I used to go and spend a lot of time at the Lincoln Memorial. I love two memorials in D.C., the Lincoln Memorial and the Jefferson Memorial.
Power ranking of memorials, go.
Yeah, right, exactly. And so, I spent a lot of time in that space thinking about these figures and what they meant and how I can translate them in 1976. And so I finally made up my mind. I go to my mother and I say, hey, I decided I'm going to become a Republican. And she looked at me and said, what the hell are you going to do that for? So much for free thinking. What was it like for your parents when you finally said, hey, I'm gonna have a little fun on the right?
They were kind of oblivious to the entire like dynamic of the left right spectrum. They were technically Democrats because it was Boston and everyone had to be a Democrat. But I think my father was way more socially conservative, and my mom would definitely rant about the welfare state and how like there were certain people who weren't allowed to get money like who shouldn't be getting their money and was spending their checks on like blah, blah, blah. So I don't think they saw my going to like professional right wingerness as a horrifically bad thing. And I think that's sort of a dynamic that people, especially like media types, miss when it comes to minorities. Like, okay, sure, the Republicans threw a lot more barriers up in order for them to get here. But like, just because the Democrats let them into the country doesn't necessarily mean they don't have socially conservative values.
Right.
And I don't, and like, they weren't really plugged into the entire libertarian moment, Tea Party moment thing. But they, my mom, at least, my dad had left the picture at this point, but my mom was at the very least like, look, as long as you can get a job and have health insurance and don't graduate with a lot of student debt,
mom's
fine,
practical.
Do whatever it is you want.
Mom is very practical. And it's just,
yes,
like,
exactly.
Look, okay, at the end of the day, this is the bottom line. You know, and so it's that bottom line approach is what I take from the MAGA diaries. You tell a funny story. It's you tell a serious story about your journey into this space. You discover a lot about the differentiation between, as you mentioned before, conservatism, republicanism, and MAGA. I've been trying in this time, and so I'd love to have your help on this, to get people to understand that they are not all the same. I can be Republican and not MAGA. I can be MAGA and not a Republican or a conservative. I can be conservative and none of the above. There is, we want to, it's convenient, and the press does this a lot. You work for PUC, you worked across a number of spaces in journalism. And so you see this as well, where people just want to categorize you and put you in the box. They want to lump all Republicans in the conservative box. Mm-hmm. They want to lump all conservatives and MAGA in the Republican box. How do we break that down? How do we distinguish one from the other? And or should we? Is it really the same?
I think it's actually a better goal to try to distinguish them, because I had a libertarian friend of mine read this book, and he kind of like skews more on the like Jeffersonian side of things. Mm-hmm. But he was like, I think it's actually very important to be able to distinguish what people believe inside half of the country, because if you decide to make half of the country, if you try to demonize half of the country, then that's just going to lead to a horrible, horrible thing. And
right.
You just have to understand that within this one giant red blob, there are people who have pretty opposing views to each other. Like, I think for me, the categorization between the three is that like Republicans still kind of hew to a Reagan-esque vision of the world, free markets, strong American government, like strong American presence in the world, pro-democratic views. Conservatives, I would say, are more Tea Party, limited government but open markets, free trade. And then MAGA,
constitutional.
All
about the Constitution.
Yeah, and then MAGA is more of a stylistic choice than it is an ideology. It's more of a like reactionary, it's a reaction to what they believe a set of elites are deciding above them,
right?
Whether they're Republican, whether they're Democrat, whatever. And the best way for them to take it on is literally just like brawling, punch drunk, do like pull whatever levers are necessary, take the entire ship crashing down. They just don't want to live like this anymore.
Yeah, I think that's a great summation of it. And certainly, you know, I'm familiar with all strains of that, because, you know, having served at various levels inside the party, and of course, having Tea Party emerge during my time as national chairman, you know, I had a very up close view of that. I was in the room with, you know, a number of Tea Party leaders from across the country, literally 4 months into the job, you know, and they were angry because the party had moved off of its constitutional moorings, right? Mm-hmm. And so they were all about the, you know, the big government republicanism of the Bush era. You know, why, you know, we spent all this money on wars. We, you know, we lost lives. We created national debt. You know, we expanded the role and size of government in the lives of people. So they had a whole fixation there. And then, you know, they boot me out because they don't like winning anymore. So I, you know, I'm gone. And
but
then
the principles.
Right. then the MAGA thing emerges as a continuation, yes, but as a further response to the frustrations that the Tea Party folks had, to your point, where they figured, okay, we've expressed our anger, we've told you we're mad, we wanted you to do something about it. Screw it, burn it all down.
Exactly, yes. I was talking to someone recently about the book, and he was recounting to me his own experiences in his early, like in early Tea Party for him as well. And he's like, I mean, look, I had a lot of issues with the way that the Bush era Republican Party was run, but the Tea Party wanted me to solve everything with white papers. And I was like, screw this, I can't.
Right, right. That's exactly right. And the irony is the Tea Party, you know, they were willing to work within the structures as they existed to a point. I remember having conversations when they were starting to take out a number of our candidates who could only win in those districts or states that they were currently elected. So you had someone, you know, in New Jersey or Delaware or Utah. You have U.S. senators, you know, and I'm like, these individuals are the only ones who can hold these seats. You can't put a Tea Party person in. So you get the Christine O'Donnell effect in a number of races. So I had to call everybody back and say, stop taking out the people who can win these races. And they were willing to work within the system. So we worked it out. We had a number of Tea Party candidates. Joe Walsh, for example, of Illinois, was one of our Tea Party candidates, strong Tea Party guy. Mm-hmm. That we backed. I brought the bus to his backyard and campaigned for him. But there were all also more traditional Republicans that we got elected. Tim Scott in South Carolina to the House. So we worked out the level of engagement, and so the internal destruction stopped. This is not the case today. These guys, they don't really, MAGA doesn't care whether it is external, internal. They when they talk about deconstructing the administrative state, that's everything.
Right, exactly. And it's funny, having reported on the right over the past 7-8 years, exactly how far the dismantling of the constitutional like framework and administrative state and all of the norms has gone. Like, there was this recent thing I did for Puck where I went into the freaky deaky rhetoric and stories floating around in the media of like, oh, there's a Trump administration in waiting. Ooh, no, how terrible.
Right.
And my media thought was like, wait a second, why are people openly talking about this? If you were going to do this and it was like a real plan, you'd be doing it very quietly. But like, there are these guys going on the record talking about their plans. And so I look into it and it turns out that there are two groups competing to be the quote unquote Trump administration in waiting. One of them is backed by Heritage, longstanding conservative think tank, probably the engine of all of Reagan's policies back in the day. And then there's the America First Policy Institute, which was founded after Trump's first administration to be sort of the landing zone for these Trump policymakers. And both of them were going around to donors being like, oh, we've got the best Trump administration in waiting.
Right.
And initially I was like, okay, no, is this just like a bunch of people trying to grift or whatever? Is there like an actual difference here? And I was looking into it, and the summary is that Heritage is trying to take like the policy ideas that have come out of MAGA era Trumpism that seem popular and winnable, and then like wrap them in a constitutional paper and put a little like this is legal bow on it. Whereas AFPI is more Trumpist in that they will try to like take whatever Trump has decided to do at any moment and like wrap it in some sort of like post facto justification.
Right. So, yeah, the heritage people, they do have the, what is it, the Project 2025, where they're,
yeah, that's what it was, yeah.
They're looking to, you know, stockpile the government with Trump loyalists. That's concerning to me. But, you know, but that's part of the makeup of that. So let's get into the meat of the MAGA Diaries, because you weave a very interesting tale of your experience in the world of Bannon, in the world of Tucker Carlson, whom you worked for, which I got Tucker stories.
we but, all have good Tucker stories.
None of them good. But the reality of it is, you have a very interesting insight as a young woman emerging in her own right in politics at the time you are immersed in politics. Tell us a little bit about the MAGA Diaries and where you were going with this. What is the story you wanted to tell? What wanted people to walk away at the end of reading your diaries about your experience?
Ultimately, I think it's a story about watching a whole bunch of institutions fail at once in very close proximity.
Oh, Tina, you just struck a chord in my heart. Keep going,
girl. I'm so sorry. I'm very sorry about that.
It's all good. No, it's good. It's good. I'm with you. I'm 1,000% with you.
Yeah, like here's the odd position I found myself in when people started pitching me on writing this book. Like, I had ended up in the mainstream media working at Vanity Fair, which is like the most elitist magazine out there.
Right.
And when my editor started realizing that I could like rattle off all of these random facts about Steve Bannon or Matt Boyle or Tucker Carlson, who had now started like popping up in Trump's universe. And they're like, wait, how did you know him that well? And I was like, oh yeah, I was part of the movement. And their minds just broke. And they were just thinking like, wait, how did you get into this? What? No. But the fact that the entire media, everyone I ran into when I was living in New York working for these papers, that they would look at me and then had this weird idea of who I must have been in order to have existed in that movement to begin with was so crazy. And like, it probably was more difficult for you because you were an actual like Republican, but I was just little miss journalist here, and people were learning about my background and going, wait, were you actually like hateful towards Black people when you were younger? Were you a Nazi? And first of all, and initially I was looking back at my past going, wait, was I a Nazi?
Was I Nazi? Right.
Was I?
Mom.
Mom, why did you not stop me from being a Nazi? But it also just like, it's me trying to answer a question of exactly how did the Republican Party get to a place where Trump could be elected, but then also why is it that the other half of the country could not see it coming, and why can't the other side counter him in any way? Why is it that the other side is always like shocked by whatever he does? Because I could just see this coming. I'm sure you had a sense that like any of the things that could happen in the Trump administration could happen.
Yes.
But as when I like sort of, I torched my Republican past as a 22-year-old and moved to New York and tried to start over, but I just kept running into blocks and blocks and blocks and blocks of ignorance about why Trump could have been a thing at all. And so it's funny the way that people have been receiving this book, because people from the more mainstream liberal side of it are like, oh my God, you've been unveiling this terrible world underneath the surface that we didn't know about. And then people on the right are looking at it going like, yes, I recognize this world so instinctively. And now I can see like the failures of the credentialed meritocracy in the world that you moved to.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I hate using the words both sides here, but it's not like I'm giving each side credit so much as I watched each side like collapse up close.
Yeah. And that's an interesting perspective. Cause for me, I watched the formation of the conservative movement pretty much close to the beginning. So you saw this sort of convergence of the philosophical, the William F. Buckley, narratives that were emerging in the 60s and 70s, aligned with the political sort of elevation of Ronald Reagan, and how that all coalesced in the 1980 campaign and started that trend line. And so you were on the front end of that sort of development and sort of watching it forming, and you're seeing it really from inside the tent, if you will, in a way that those outside the tent initially don't recognize until it's too late. And then they overreact to what they see in so many instances. Thus, were you a Nazi when you were a kid? You know,
exactly.
Yeah, we just goose stepped around the house all day long. It was the way we played. But it's an interesting storyline in that you really begin to appreciate not only how something starts, but then how it changes and becomes something else. And so a lot of people today sort of lump the Tea Party and MAGA into the same bucket and saying they're the same thing. And I'm like, they're not. Something's Tea Party was done probably by 2014, and for the most part, a lot of the folks that I got elected were on their way out the door. Joe Walsh, that I mentioned earlier, was kicked out of Congress after one term, so he was only there until 2013, and he was gone. You began to see that kind of emergence of this other thing, this transformation into something else, that to me was a very fascinating part of the storyline. You also write, and I love this. This again, there's so much of what you touch for me in this book, because it's so true. You talk about whenever someone, this quote from the book, folks, whenever someone asks me why I cover the far right instead of the far left, particularly my conservative sources, irked that a mainstream reporter is chasing after them, I have two answers. First of all, the left is incompetent. I cannot even begin to express how true that is. Let's talk about that from the perspective that you have been able to, and actually why it is seemingly so much easier for this hard right white nationalism to function the way it does, because there is roughly an incompetent counterbalance to what they're doing. Talk a little bit about that, and then we'll get to your second answer.
Sure. So the first, I think I may be the only person who would tried to report on the conservative and progressive movement, but there was a hot time in about 2018 or so where I was having a lot of emotional conflict on reporting on the right, because I was like, oh no, was I secretly a Nazi? Do I have to figure myself out before I do this? Right. So I asked my boss if I could cover the left, because I thought, you know what, there must be parallel structures. Everything, there's got to be something that's similar on the left, and I want to map that out and see who's the power player here, who's funding this, who's putting together this other thing. And the left does not have that. And the more I talk to people, the more I realize it's that they're just not good at working together. And progressives especially do not have the patience that conservatives do. I think it's just a fundamental flaw. They want the future to come as soon as possible.
Yeah.
And the idea of long-term planning to slowly win people over just seems kind of anathema to their ideals. So there just seems to be this thing I keep running to with progressive activists. And I interviewed Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in this book in 2018 when she's about to take office. And her answer, I'm like, look, you have to, this is Washington. You're going to have to compromise. Are you okay with that? And she's like, no, I'm not, compromise is a bad thing. And I'm just thinking, good luck, lady. But over time, I just kept running into people who were like, oh, this guy's not funding my thing. This guy's not funding my thing. My vision is best. Your vision, their vision sucks. They just want something to happen now. But in the meantime, like, that instinct is hollowing out the Democratic Party's own infrastructure. Like, they don't have an easy bench of people to call up to run for office. They don't have like policies sitting around in their back pocket that they can ship off to a right. random state legislature because the conservative movement thinks that far in the future. And the DNC too just doesn't really have the internal organization to make a party function from the ground up that the conservatives do. I forget who told me this, but I have the, and like, this is just my observations, but I think that the Democratic Party was so reliant on the idea of one singular person at the top of the heap being able to just kind of change the world. So right. it was always like, the president's going to do this. We're going to have a good president. The president's going to be great. Everything's fine after that. Right, guys? And no, not at all. Like, I run into so many progressives over the past 8 years who have been like, yeah, you know what? We just get a bunch of like Democrats in office. That's going to be fine. I mean, no, we're just going to get a whole bunch of Democrats in Congress. Everything would be great after that. And then we can impeach Trump. And like, that's not how it works. Also think about what happens 5 years from now when your state legislatures now have supermajorities and start like Republican supermajorities and start pushing through legislation that you will think has come out of nowhere.
Thank you, guys. That is so much the story. So I got to go back to the story with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, because as national chairman, I had a candidate running for the U.S. Senate in a state, and I wanted to meet him, and because I met with all the candidates that I was backing, that I would back. Otherwise, you weren't getting any support. I had to have a conversation. So I talked to this guy. And I asked him, so what are you going to do? You know, what's your plan? He said, I want to go to Washington. I want to do all these things. All right, great. I said, well, you know, Harry Reid is the majority leader in the Senate, right? Mm-hmm. And he goes, yeah. I said, so you're going to, in order to get what you want done, and I'm behind you, we're going to be here for you, bro. That's how it works, right? But in order to do that, you're going to have to work with Mitch McConnell, who will be your majority leader, your minority leader. And you will have to work in committee to get your bill positioned to get heard, let alone voted out of committee, mm-hmm. so that it could then go to the majority leader for his consideration to bring it to the floor, because he was spouting some radical stuff. And I said, so, you know, you're going to have to go and compromise or build a consensus. He said, I'm not going to do that. I said, mm-hmm. then why are you going to Washington? He said, I'm going there because I want to get this done. I said, but you're not going to get this done. And it was a really stark moment for me, because he mm-hmm. was hell-bent on going to Washington to remake Washington in his image, not understanding right. how Washington worked. Now, I can hear people saying, well, that's the point. You know, we need people to go in and change it and shake it up. True. But you got to get into the room first. You got to know how to get in the room. You just mm-hmm. can't. I mean, you can throw rocks at the window and you can break the glass and you can overturn the furniture, but you ain't doing nothing but breaking glass and overturning furniture. You're not changing the institution. You're not moving mm-hmm. it in your direction. And so that is a fundamental misunderstanding by those who want to go in with this sort of radical idea of reinventing the institution in an image that they have in their mind. Mm-hmm. And you can hold on to that image, but you also have to, you know, dose that thing with a little bit of reality, because that's the game and how it's going to work.
And I think that's also the appeal of the MAGA movement itself, because Trump did not give a flying fuck. I'm sorry, right. I may swear.
No, that's right. That's absolute. Go fine.
All right. Yes. He just did not care about any of the rules of Washington. And he also had executive authority to push things his way.
Right.
Caveat this with, I don't think a second Trump administration is going to function the same way the first Trump administration did, because the way that Trump flexed his power during that period was in a much different environment than the one he is in now. Like, I think that Trump was incredibly good at getting people to bend his way, because he was a great internet bully.
Right.
And the chain of attack would always be like, It's 12 p.m. Trump tweets out something. At 5 p.m., a journalist on the breaking news desk picks it up and tells someone who's going to be on the floor in Congress to go ask this congressman, hey, Trump called you XYZ. What is your response? And it's just like this incredible domino effect of internet bullying that probably can't be replicated now, but in some sense, like, could be in the future. And through that, Trump was able to get a lot of things done. And I don't know exactly how, now that he has a better sense of exactly what he can and can't do as president, I'm really wondering what that's going to look like if he gets back into office.
So we're having a great conversation with Tina Nguyen about her new book, The MAGA Diaries, My Surreal Adventures Inside the Right Wing and How I Got Out. The question was why she covers the far right instead of the far left. She gave us the first answer. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back for the second answer right after this.
Is it just me or have we all lost our minds? It's a question more and more people are asking themselves, afraid to admit they already know the answer. It's also a podcast, one about people coming together in a time of division and uncertainty to talk about culture and politics, compromise and connections. It's about challenging the norms we've come to accept as a society and working together to find common ground. Fierce and Unfiltered, host Jennifer Horn is a former Republican strategist and party leader turned independent sanity activist. One way or another, we've all lost our minds. Join Jennifer Horn in the search to find them again.
Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele Podcast. I'm having a wonderful conversation with my new friend, Tina Nguyen. We've been working this journey together and didn't even know it. At different spaces in time. So Tina, before we went to break, we were talking about you were in the book, you talk about how people always ask you, you know, why you cover the far right instead of the far right, far left. And your first answer was, you know, because the left is incompetent. And the second part of your answer, which I think is really applicable at this hour as we're getting ready to go into the 2024 cycle. You say the second answer is that sometimes I don't think the left or even people who consider themselves centrist, center right, or even a regular card carrying Republican who's wondering why everyone went batshit over the last 5 years understands even now the scale or geography of the mountain that's in their way. I'd even go so far as to mix metaphors and say it's a mountain that's also a perfectly calibrated Rube Goldberg machine, a bit too elaborately constructed with hundreds, if not thousands, of different pieces that need to be placed just so in order to achieve a specific outcome. That is so true. You know, this idea that the left sees the mountain and their view is, well, we'll just go right through it. Mm-hmm. Or somehow it would just magically disappear.
We're going to tell the mountain a really strong story and everyone will change their minds and go, oh, I was wrong the entire time.
Right.
There you go.
And the mountain will get up and move itself. talk about that in the context of your covering the MAGA movement from inside and outside. How that sets up the narrative for this 2024 cycle. You have a left that is, you know, pulling their hair out and really is strategically behind where the right is right now. And you have a right that knows that and takes advantage of it at every turn.
Yeah, exactly. The conservative movement is a machine and a network and an ideology, but they have been incredibly good at figuring out how to take each other's internal structures and replicate them over time. So you've got your Heritage Foundation, which kind of sits there and pumps out think tank papers and gets in donors and kind of designates who is and is not conservative. Mm-hmm. But just because there's one Heritage Foundation doesn't mean you can't create that model elsewhere. It's
right.
Got like a bajillion think tanks that are trying to be their own version of Heritage for their own ideals. You've got journalism programs like the one I came out of, that are trying to find young generations of journalists and shape them in a very specific intellectual mold to send them out in the world and just like seed conservative right-wing ideas into the ecosphere. You've got right-wing news outlets who have over time been funded specifically to provide right of center news. And the idea of that went from like a pretty noble, you know what, maybe the liberal media doesn't consider these stories, to we're just going to spout a whole bunch of conspiracy theories in the air and no one can tell us no.
Right.
And the thing, like, these are all independent entities, but everyone knows each other, or everyone somehow knows someone who knows that person. And I think that is the key differentiator between the left and the right, is that like the right, if you just like poke a little bit hard enough, you'll find maybe 2 or 3 degrees of separation, and at least you'll know like where they worked. Right. And that background is immediately like, oh, I get you. I see you. It's sort of like, I don't know, being a member of the Ivy League or something and trying to hire for like if you got a Yale student versus some like Vanderbilt student, you'll hire the Yale student because and the progressive movement just does not have that immediate like facility and connection with each other. And which I think is to their detriment, because when you've got like a community of people who've known each other or have like their forefathers who've known each other for 60, 70 years, like you're more inclined to work together than somebody who just like came from some random college. And like that was the entire, that was all of the progressive movement, and that was all of the like, and that was all of the Democrats I ever spoke to.
Just that kind of thinking around how to, it's an interesting bubble. I've been trying to help them pop it, but Lord knows it is not an easy one.
They just cannot think in that mindset at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Republicans must hate. Let's like all hang out with each other because they're equally hateful.
Right. Yeah. And I'm like, no, that's it. And it informs everything that they do, to the extent that they wind up doing nothing. There is no counterweight to anything. So instead of calibrating a response that has a political, undercutting to it, they have this, it's much more of an emotional response that people look at and generally kind of tune out. Mm-hmm. Because there is no, it's like, oh my God. And instead of, you know, hey, why don't we put up an ad that says this? Why don't we put up an ad or put out a narrative that says that? You know, I tell them all the time, I said, why are we talking about Joe Biden's age? Why do you guys talk about Joe Biden's age as much as you do? Well, because he's old. And you know why you recognize Joe Biden is old? That to the point where you're now sitting there biting your fingernails down to the nub? Because Republicans told you he was old. And they kept saying it over and over and over again. And you bought that shit. And you're the ones. I mean, Republicans aren't running around talking about Kamala Harris and Joe Biden's age and all. They just throw something out in the ether. You guys run with it. And they sit back and go, thank you. My work is done.
The messaging apparatus on the right is just so much better than the left. There's a concept I actually come up with that I actually talk about in the book called the infinite fringe. And I'm trying to develop this into a more like cohesive theory. Mm-hmm. But when I first started reporting on the MAGA movement and its clash with the traditional conservatives of like the Republican Party, mm-hmm. I was always thinking about that moment where William F. Buckley pushed hard against the John Birch Society in order to get them out of the movement.
Yes.
And this was a super conspiratorial wing of the GOP Republican right at the time that Buckley just did not want involved in what he hoped the conservative movement would look like, because they're like batshit conspiracy theorists. And so he devoted years of his life, was fighting every single person who wrote into his magazine, writing op-eds about how the Birchers were bad, expending like pretty significant political capital on it. And he was pretty successful. The Birchers were no longer there. And I think they're like almost kind of a dead movement, But the thing is that I was always waiting for that moment to happen on the right when Trump came in, and people tried and they tried and it just could not happen. And they fired people from their publications and they condemned them online. But the thing is that the person they were trying to get at, like trying to get rid of, would not be silenced.
Right.
Buckley could do that because he owned the biggest conservative paper of the time.
Right.
Fox could do that with Tucker because they had the airwaves. But the moment that you can go like on the internet and take your following with you and say, oh, you can't cancel me, I'm going to say the truth from over here, their followership goes with them.
Yep.
And as long as that person can talk like whatever they think the truth is, that version of the truth is still going to exist. If someone in that orbit gets fired, he can go even further and just like start saying his shit over there, and someone will keep following him. Someone in his universe get fired, he goes there, and on and on and on and on.
Well, we've seen that with Tucker and Fox now going off and starting his own thing. We saw that with Trump himself when Fox shut him down. What did he do? Okay, it's Truth Social. I'll create another platform to continue.
Right.
The Birchers didn't have that against Buckley. And it speaks a lot, Tina, to the social media component. That is both the seed and the poison that sort of infects politics in a way that stuff grows, but it's not necessarily all good.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got the seed, right? It is a great, you know, it's got this opportunity to sort of, you know, really inform and take people to great places, but there's also a poisonous strain of it that you've got to be guarded against. And that's the difficult part, because you make a really good point of how much easier it is for the Proud Boys and Tucker to align in a different space, even though the institutions of Fox and the body politic push them out. They can just go take their followers and grow their followers from that different space.
Exactly. Like over in that corner, and they have allies with Elon Musk, who now owns Twitter, X, whatever.
Right.
They'll have a giant network of free thinking podcasters who will be like, yeah, you know what? You're allowed to say what you want to say. And they'll be able to continue to being on those shows. And look, the entire blob itself existing is always a pretty terrifying thing, especially since there seems to be no one singular, there is like no singular person in that blob in the infinite fringe who has like the power, and you can point to them and be like, yes, this is the most powerful person. But like the overall existence of it is based on the idea that the people who were in the center and used to be the gatekeepers of information are bad. So like, yeah, your National Reviews, but you're also your New York Timeses and your Vanity Fairs and all of the newspapers and news outlets that used to dictate what was and was not news.
Right, right. Talk to us a little bit. You go through your associations in the book, and you've had a lot. You've been in a lot of rooms with folks. Give us a sense of the impact of a Mike Johnson, a Tucker Carlson, Matt Boyle, and of course Steve Bannon. On all of this and how they've played a role in shaping this current version of Republican / conservatism in
I would say that they were the first examples of the infinite fringe breaking out of the Republican Party. Like the reason that they started their businesses online was because, one, they were cheap. Like it was cheap to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And two, they had way more control over what they could say on their outlet than they would if they were trying to play nice with someone in print media or television. And they did start out with pretty noble intentions, I think, but the incentive structure of the internet is such that eyeballs and clicks and views immediately translate into money and relevance.
Mm-hmm.
And the more eyeballs you can get on your content, the better, and the more, and at some point you will start having to resort to some pretty insane shit in order to get eyeballs on your site. When I was at the Caller, it was a pretty innocent time, and I think what we were doing were bikini slideshows or something, because slideshows,
yes.
We were like little like internet gremlins and were like, hey, hey, bikini photos of like hot Israeli ladies. But also too, the slideshow format counted as a page view. And then you could take that metric and be to your advertiser and be like, see, we got this many views. Right. Hey, it's more money.
Right.
But then at a certain point after I left, there was a, there was an op-ed editor there who was secretly connected to a white nationalist group that was trying to insert white nationalist ideas into conservative papers. And it was really easy for him to do that at the Daily Caller because they needed clicks and page views and to fill out the content.
Right.
So if you, so it's a matter, I think that period of time was like, exactly what can we do with the internet and the commons, and like, can we can anyone control the commons of the internet? And if they can't, what can we do here? And also, right, how can we maintain money and relevance? And that is just like a really twisted incentive that took those four guys you talked about in weird directions.
Yeah, yeah, it really did. And for me, I've always said, because I've seen it inside, and then I can almost pinpoint some moments when it began, this idea of recognizing the dollar value of political movements, political ideas, political energy, translating that into a grift. And it becomes a much easier thing to do. So I'll go out and say something that is a load of crap. And then someone will respond to my load of crap. That's because that's what I want. I want my crap out there, but then I want you to respond to it. And when you do, oh my God, I'm a victim. Look at what they're doing to me. Look at what they're saying about me. Send me $5. and so I'll feel better if you send me $5. I'll feel so much better. And then I get my, you know, poor little sons and family members, if you're Donald Trump, to go out and say, my daddy's under attack. Send him some money just to, you know, help him with his legal bills, you know, all of this crazy stuff. But the other aspect beyond the grift is what's important to note. And again, you know, I had an issue with the Daily Caller and their quote journalism when I was RNC chairman, and Tucker showed me everything that he was in that moment when we gave him the truth, we gave him the verification of the truth, and he ran with the lie. And that was the breaking moment for me with him. And I understood, okay, you're an asshole. I got it. Good to know. Cause now I know where you are on my chessboard. You also talk about the realization of finding where people were on the chessboard when you write about Nazis showing up at the Turning Point USA Student Action Summit that you were at in 2022. The question is, why did these students believe that these are fake Nazis or leftist infiltrators, impersonators? Why did people believe that January 6th was actually all Antifa and not Trump supporters? You have the Proud Boys, as you note in your book, you know, admitting to blending in with other protesters as a way to avoid being noticed as supremacists. You know, this lack of self-awareness within the movement of the people around them and who they are. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's a question that I still kind of grapple with answering, to be quite honest, because I mean, yeah, you can talk about the media silos of the right now, who's getting information from what, how the truth is presented. But there's also a level of like conspiratorial.
Right.
I don't know exactly if that's the best word, but like, it's a really weird dynamic when you have a Nazi in front of you and you think like you don't want the Nazi there to begin with, but you could just say, get out of here, you Nazi, you suck, rather than I don't believe you're a Nazi at all. I honestly couldn't answer why it is that people in the movement must believe that. Maybe it's a self-defense mechanism. I have no idea.
Right.
Like that's some deep core, like organizational psychology shit that I'm not quite ready to answer. And I really want to be. At some point I will have an answer to this, but it will, I think more data is needed.
But
I will say it is definitely an organizational psychology question that needs to be asked.
Yeah.
If the MAGA movement is premised on believing that the world is one way, it clearly goes beyond whatever Donald Trump is saying at any given time. And because he's no longer on Twitter, he's not there to give the marching orders of the right wing at any given moment or bully them into submission or whatever. He right. is still very powerful, though. So powerful enough that he just stomped over Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis in the Iowa caucus.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
It's like, what is it that's going on in the mind of Trump voters and Republican voters on that side that is already just making them believe that there is a plot to silence Donald Trump to the point that the left will dress up as fake Nazis and Antifa infiltrators on January 6th. Since Trump is not the one who's saying that, it is something that is very deeply ingrained in this movement. And yeah. I can't quite define it yet, but I think that's sort of where it is.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I think it's also kind of, it harkens back to that Birchian strain that never really went away. Mm-hmm. You said at one point, you said, I think they're no longer, they are. I mean, but it's yes. a different iteration, different form of it that exists. And it exists at a different level within the body politic. It lay dormant for a long, long time. Donald Trump pricked that particular space. Mm-hmm. They recognized the connection, and that connection was instant because they watched Donald Trump for 14 years be the strong man, right? Mm-hmm. He was firing people on national television. He was hanging out at beauty pageants that he owned with beautiful women, all these things. So these narratives, as they subsequently emerge around him, these people became much more defensive of him, so that in a sense, he kind of protected them. Mm-hmm. And they protected him. So, yeah, Nazis and white supremacists in Charlottesville are very fine people because they're my people. Mm. And so you begin to see the development of the symbiosis between him and them.
Right.
He gives them good quarter inside the party. Come, rest yourselves here.
Right.
Drink freely, eat and drink freely from my table.
Trump is the one doing the inviting. It's just a matter of can he convince the rest of the party that it's totally okay for these Nazis to be hanging out with you guys?
Yes. Yes. And the leadership largely says it's okay because we have a candidate running for president who thinks slavery was about economics. We have a candidate running for president who basically said that, slaves learned great job skills. It was a great jobs program. Slavery was a great jobs program for Black people. When mm-hmm. you cannot deal effectively with the truth of the story, right? About slavery, about race mm-hmm. in the country, about those who hate people who look like you, who look like me. It becomes a very difficult story to tell, but one in which the leadership of the party, you would hope, at least as we saw with William F. Buckley, with other political leaders back in the late 50s, early 60s, who pushed back on the John Birch Society, stand mm-hmm. up and do the same with MAGA. But they didn't. Mm. They capitulated. And that is where the problem lies.
Yeah, I don't think the conservative movement had a good immune system towards populism at all. And I don't know whether it was a structural flaw or whether it was a vision thing or whether it was arrogance of thinking no, everyone must like conservatism.
Right.
It's always going to be the best. And if we just if we just put out a whole bunch more white papers, they'll understand our vision.
Right. Tina, I could go on and on with you. There's so much more in the book that we could get into. But what I'm going to do is recommend to people that you get this book. If you want to get an inside view and understanding through the eyes of the journey of this young conservative woman who then emerges into her own realization about the space she's in and where she wants to go, pick up the MAGA Diaries, My Surreal Adventures Inside the Right Wing, and How I Got Out by Tina Nguyen. You are an absolute joy to talk to. Feels so good with the conversation and helping to give some context to what we see happening around us right now.
Yeah, totally. And I really hope that, like, for anyone listening, I know that my topics are really depressing, but I'm a pretty fun person, I think. So
I get that a lot, too. It's like, oh, my God. Can you at least tell us something good? No, I need to wake your ass up. That's why I'm
Come on, everybody. Let's just get on the train with us. You gotta hang out, dude.
Exactly.
We gotta go scream and take some tires to a quarry and fling them in there and scream about our frustrations.
Exactly. Take up some time with Tina also through her writing as a correspondent for Puck. I get Puck every morning, in fact, I just saw your name pop up on my feed this morning. I thought it was related to the podcast, but it was from Puck.
Thank you for plugging my day job too.
Yeah, no, you're really good over there, and give my best to the folks at Puck. And thank you for spending some time with my crew here at the Michael Steele Podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right, folks, that does it for this time together. You know I love it when you do that voodoo and download and share the love with folks out there, especially on this episode. Get it out there. I want folks to hear what Tina has to say. Pick up a copy of the MAGA Diaries and begin to understand exactly what's happening and why it's happening. Share the love with Tina as well. You know, help a sister out, as we like to say. Until next time, be well and take care, y'all. Later.
Facepalm America is a show for progressives and others on the left who want to keep up with the ridiculousness that this country dishes out. Find out what cable news misses when they're waiting for Trump to appear at a podium. And also, every once in a while, get a laugh at how silly this hot mess of a nation of ours really is. If that's you, listen to Facepalm America. You can go to facepalmamerica.com or find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.